Public Service Project, a collection of public service origin stories. I'm Kate Dallaire, and I'm connecting with current and former public servants, one human and one story at a time. We are thinking through why we chose careers in service and what we've learned along the way. Today, I have the privilege of speaking with Dylan Lang. Dylan is a lawyer, social worker, and human rights activist with over a decade of experience working at the intersection of diplomacy, law, and social justice. He most recently served as a senior foreign affairs officer at the U.S. Department of State and previously worked at the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. He holds a JD from New England Law, Boston, an MSW Masters of Social Work from Boston College, and a Bachelor's in Counseling and Human Services from the University of Scranton. Dylan, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. I'm really excited to be here.
I'm happy that you're here too. And look, we're twins.
We
have matching headphones, matching outfits. Are you also wearing gingerbread socks or no?
I am not, but it's better. No one can see what's going on below the
We're both smile, professional so. On the top and like,
exactly.
I assume PJs on the bottom.
Correct.
So it's like the mullet of outfits and I love it.
Exactly.
All right. Well, I'm so happy to have you here. We worked together previously in I.O. at the State Department, and I know that not only are you an exceptional foreign affairs officer, you're also just a wonderful human being. So thank you for being here with me, and I can't wait to learn more about you.
Thanks. I'm really excited to talk a little bit more about my background.
Yeah. So let's start with your background. Where did you grow up, and who raised you, and how did all of that kind of shape your values?
Yeah, you know, I had a pretty, what I would consider like quote unquote stereotypical American family. I grew up with my mom, my dad, a sister, and a dog in New Jersey, right outside of New York City. So New York was a fun weekend trip for us. And I had a really great childhood generally. I grew up really close with my extended family as well, all my grandparents and even my great grandma for a while. So I was really fortunate in that respect. My parents, you know, they were always really supportive of me and they wanted me to succeed and just told me constantly to follow my dreams. I remember growing up, my mom always said to me and my sister, you know, I don't really care how you follow your path, what path you choose. As long as one of you gives me grandkids, that's all I really care about. Still working on that, so we'll see how that goes.
But she was clear in her expectation.
Yes, she was very clear. But, you know, I was the first in my immediate family to go to college. So it was really kind of a new path for my family of the educational world. So it was new.
Me too, by the way. And it's scary when you're the first one, right?
Yeah, it was really scary. We really didn't know what we were doing. And, you know, student loans was a whole separate conversation that we just kind of did.
Oh, my God. The FAFSA.
The FAFSA is really complicated.
Yes.
It's really complicated. So, you know, So I had a really great childhood. I remember really often visiting my great grandma, and she would always call me her little helper or her caretaker, because whenever I was visiting her, I was always helping her around the house and fixing things. And I always just kind of had a passion for helping people. And so when high school came around, my freshman year of high school, I lost my grandpa to lung cancer, and it was really difficult for me. And at that time, I became really close with my high school guidance counselor, and she had shared with me that she was actually a two-time cancer survivor herself.
Wow.
So we really bonded over that experience, and she was a big help to me. We got really close, and then a couple years later during high school, she actually pulled me aside one day and told me that she had just been diagnosed with cancer for the third time.
Oh my gosh.
And it was really difficult. You know, I instead turned and then I was the one that was there for her during her journey. And so it was a really special bond that the two of us had. She really became like a second mother to me. And, you know, she became close with my family and I became close with her family. And we stayed in touch for years and years to come. And she, I was actually able to bring her to my college and present her with an award for being one of my role models and inspirations. So that was really special to me. And so she really was the inspiration for me wanting to make a difference and enter the helping profession when I got to see the difference that she was able to make on me. And I wanted to do that for other people.
That is so beautiful. And I'm sorry for the losses and the grief that you've experienced. And I'm also so happy for you that you had someone like that in your life. And it sounds like you probably were kind of an old soul as a young person.
I was.
Is that true?
I was. I really was. You know, yeah. I was the one that was spending more time in the guidance counselor's office hanging out and having lunch than I was outside playing sports or doing any of that.
Yeah. So then it makes sense that when you went to college, you decided to study counseling.
Yes, exactly.
But then you went to law school. What inspired you to make that shift?
Yeah, you know, there was just kind of a series of events that happened when I was in college that led me down my next career path. So, you know, I studied counseling and I wasn't exactly sure what route I wanted to go. You know, most people end up going and getting a master's in something. But in college, I did a semester with the Office of Youth and Family Services in Pennsylvania. And then I did a semester with a family court judge and a guardian ad litem, which was super cool and something not a lot of college kids get to do.
Yeah.
It's usually reserved for law school students. And I was really struck by the fact that, you know, despite these two systems, the social work and the law systems working together so closely, the social workers that I was working with really just didn't understand the law or the legal system. And then the lawyers didn't really understand what was happening in the social work world and what was going on at home and why the trauma and all these things were impacting these cases. So it was really then that I decided and committed, you know what, I need to get a social work degree and I need to go to law school. And so I went right from college to get my master's in social work. And then right from my master's, I went right to law school. So a lot of schooling.
No breaks.
No breaks at all.
Did you like being in school? Did you like the actual process of being in school?
Yeah, I really, really did. I love learning. And so any opportunity I can to learn, I really take it. And, you know, it was really cool programs that I got to do. The social work program was really incredible. And it didn't feel like school to me because it was really just taking care of yourself and other people and learning how to be a better person. And I had really great experiences there. And law school, you know, I had a better experience, I think, than some, because I went in with the understanding that, you know, I don't want to be this private firm attorney. Yeah. I know that no matter what I do out of law school, it's going to be helping people. And so I went in with that mindset, and I think I had a little less pressure than some of my other colleagues that went into law school with me too.
That makes sense. And I actually think if you go into anything with a clear idea of what you want to get out of it, and why you're there, it helps. And that's why a lot of people that I've talked to who are not sure, like maybe they finished undergrad, they're interning, and they're not sure if they want to go to grad school or when or what they would study, I always say take the time to be clear on what you want to get out of it. So for you, you kind of already knew and you were able to just plow ahead. But for many people, they're not sure and they go to grad school as just kind of like a next step. And I think you get so much more out of the experience when you have a clear direction and you know exactly what you want to extract from that opportunity.
Absolutely, absolutely. I say the same thing to people that talk to me about going to grad school. You know, it's a big time commitment and financial commitment to make.
Yes.
And if you're not fairly certain that it's what you want to do, I always recommend taking some time to do internships or work or do some things to figure out exactly what you want to do before you make that big commitment, because it really is a big commitment.
Yeah, it's a huge commitment. And so then you ended up taking all of that material and frankly, I think a lot more vision than most people have that early in their lives and their careers, but you had a vision of how you wanted to combine these two disciplines and make them your path. But then you went into federal service through the Presidential Management Fellows Program, which other people on this show have also done, and it's an amazing program. But you're the first person I've talked to who served at the CDC, and you did that at the height of the COVID pandemic. So can you talk to me about becoming a PMF, going to the CDC, and what your experience was like there?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, PMF was not something I had ever heard of, frankly, when I was in law school. But one of my mentors pulled me aside one day and said, "Hey, have you heard of this program?" And I had not. And I was reading about it and it sounded really great. You know, it's a great entryway into the federal government service because it can be really hard to get your foot in the door sometimes. And so I applied on a whim after talking to her and I was really fortunate enough to get it. And so once you became a PMF finalist, you then get to apply for all these different federal jobs. So I was applying to basically anything that sounded interesting at the time because I was really scared I wouldn't get a job out of law school.
So and you weren't focused on one agency or anything. You were like across the board.
Yeah, I applied all across the board to anything that sounded interesting to me. And a job at CDC sounded really cool. It was doing congressional affairs work, and I, at the time, was doing an internship with a state senator in Massachusetts, so I had really started to like the congressional, the legislative work. And so I got an offer and I accepted it in January 2020.
You're like, this will be an average year.
Yeah, you know, I was like, I don't really know what CDC is. They do, you know, the weird diseases and things that you see on like TV shows, and it sounded cool. So
yeah,
I accepted it, and little did I know.
Shouldn't be in the spotlight or anything.
No, no, not at all. Not controversial whatsoever. And so, you know, I accepted that, having no idea what I was in for. And I started in July 2020. You know, I was in Boston for school, and they told me, you need to move down to Atlanta, because when this COVID thing's over in a couple weeks, you'll have to be back in the office.
Yeah.
And obviously we know how that went. I never set foot in the office the entire time I was there. So it was a really interesting time. I was working on congressional affairs for the National Center for Emerging and Zoonotic Infectious Diseases, which is a mouthful, but really, to me, it was the center that did all of the stereotypical things of what one thinks CDC does. So it was all of the foodborne, waterborne, animal-borne diseases. So everything from Zika to Lyme disease to mad cow disease. So I learned a lot about all kinds of things. I definitely became a little bit of a hypochondriac while I was there. I always thought I had some new disease. I remember one time I was hiking and I found a tick on me, and I literally took a picture of the tick and texted our tick expert at CDC, and I was like, do I have a disease from this tick now? Do you need me to bring this tick in? What can I do?
Oh my gosh. That reminds me of when I had to take this super scary course on weapons of mass destruction in my master's program. I was like, this is horrible. Like, how many days do we have?
Exactly. It's a little scary. Yeah. But it was a really interesting time to be at the CDC. You know, I was working on non-COVID things, so it was really hard to get Congress's attention to talk about non-COVID things, obviously, for good reason. And while I was there, I did 2 months on the COVID emergency response team, which was really, really cool. I specifically remember one day that I worked setting up a briefing for senators. So it was, you know, I was on this call with the CDC director and Dr. Fauci, and then all of these senators in their living rooms zooming in, because at the time everyone was still at home. And so, you know, I'm not going to name names, but there was one senator whose wife walked behind him in the middle of the Zoom briefing. It was just a really surreal experience that really is something that's going to stick with me.
No one knew how to blur their backgrounds yet. There's like cats crossing the screen.
Exactly. Yeah. No one knows what the mute button is. Still just really weird times.
But, you know, don't you feel like in a way that time also kind of humanized people and put everyone on the same level? Because actually my internship at the State Department was remote, and it was during COVID. And I met everyone and like had my first experience with working for the federal government also virtually. And I just sort of felt like with some of the like decorum that you experience in person, not a factor. It almost was easier to like learn about the substance of the work, get things done with people, and not be so concerned about everything else.
Yeah. You know, there was definitely a lot of positives and negatives, but it was definitely hard starting a job virtually because you miss a lot of those, you know, people popping by your desk and introducing themselves to you and asking you to grab coffee or lunch. But you're right. You're really laser focused in on trying to learn the work and meet people as much as you can, and really doing that intentional connection with people, because you can't pop by someone's desk and say hello. So taking the time to set up calls with people, to meet everyone and learn different things, it was definitely a different way of functioning. But I you know, it was something that I will remember, and I'm kind of happy in a way that I got to experience that, especially at the CDC, because it's just a memory I will always have.
Yeah. And so then you decided to move over to the State Department. So was that like your next rotation in your PMF program?
Yes, it was.
Okay. And so you decided to come over to the State Department, and that's where we met.
Yes.
And you began working on international human rights issues with the Bureau of International Organization Affairs. So since we were Bureau buddies, I do know more about your work than I do about a lot of other guests. But I want to ask you, as a strong advocate for LGBTQ plus rights, both personally and professionally, what was it like to get to actually engage with those issues in your work every day?
Yeah, you know, this was something that I wasn't really fully expecting when I started at the State Department. I had my human rights portfolio that I was working on, and this wasn't something that I was thinking about originally. You know, it took me a really long time and a series of weird events in grad school that made me really comfortable being out and proud as a gay man. You know, I have this very vivid memory of during grad school, I was the president of the Grad Pride Alliance, and there was an incident on campus that required a response. And so I was organizing a protest and spoke at a rally. And the mainstream media picked it up, and I was suddenly on the face of a lot of these Boston Globe and other articles. And that was actually how I came out to most of my friends and family, was through the media. So
with a splash.
With a splash, as everything I do, you know, nothing I do can be simple. So it took a lot of a lot of growth for me to eventually be able to live out and proud. And I'm happy that it happened. But when I got to State Department, I was really fortunate enough to have a boss who made it clear from the get-go that being out in the workplace was not only acceptable, but was really appreciated.
Yeah.
And then when I took on the LGBT portfolio, it really took a different meaning for me, because I suddenly started to realize very clearly that I was living a life of privilege. Me being able to be out in the workplace was a privilege, because I was fighting for the human rights of LGBT persons around the world. And I'm not talking about marriage equality here. I'm talking about the right to not be arrested or the right to not be killed because of your identity. You know, there's still about 64 countries in the world that criminalize same-sex relations, and about 12 where it's punishable by deaths. It really became important for me to live my life authentically. You know, it was a really cool experience. Working on that portfolio was definitely the highlight of my career, for sure.
What were some of the highlights of your time working on that portfolio? I know you worked with UN Security Council resolutions and things like that. Was there like a moment that sticks out to you?
Yeah, I think I had two very specific things. One was I was really proud to lead the U.S. government's efforts to adopt the very first UN resolution on the rights of intersex persons at the Human Rights Council, which was really, really amazing, because intersex persons are a very specific community that are really misunderstood. And so it was a really great opportunity to use all of my background and my skills to really educate people about the importance of understanding intersex rights. And so it was a really great opportunity. And then my other really pivotal moments were giving speeches on the floor of the United Nations on LGBT rights, which was really amazing. And it was something that was really well received by some, and actually got some national media attention by some that were not as excited about what I had to say on the floor of the UN, but it's a moment that I will remember for sure.
Yeah, that's amazing. And I love seeing how people take their lived experiences and their expertise in different areas and like bring them together to kind of create their own recipe. And in your case, I think all of the skills and tools and the language that you probably learned in your social work studies, combined with like your understanding of the law, combined with your own lived experience, and then combined with your experience of diplomacy, of navigating our bureaucracy, all of that, like I imagine that the all kind of came together in a really profound way when you had the opportunity to do those couple of really exciting things at the UN.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, it's really each piece of my background went into each of the things. So, you know, writing a speech for the UN, for example, I'm of course using my legal background to make sure that what I'm saying is legally accurate and we can say it, but I'm also using
Our lawyers loved you because they didn't have to like triple check your work.
You know, they did and they didn't, because I was coming at things from a very different perspective where I was saying, I know what you're doing because I'm also a lawyer, but I care more about the policy here. So we had some spats about that.
Because that makes sense.
Yeah. But then at the same time, I was using my social work background and making sure that, you know, the way we said things was person first, and making sure it was appropriate language that we were using. And then also making it my voice to be able to say it on the floor of the United Nations. So it really was using all of those different pieces of my background to make one thing happen.
And I don't know if our listeners will realize like how very rare and special it is that you actually had the opportunity to be the person delivering those remarks on the floor, because it's not often that it's not an ambassador. And so it's amazing that you were given that opportunity and you were the right person to deliver the message. And I'm so happy that you had that moment in time. And I hope you will have many more in the future.
Thanks. Yeah, it was very special. You're right. It's very rare.
Yeah.
You know, some people get to deliver remarks, some people write remarks, but it's very rare to write your own remarks.
Oh my gosh.
You will give. So it was really special. And, you know, I made sure I sent the link to my family and friends live on the UN when I was speaking so everyone could watch live as it was happening.
Of course.
It was a really cool experience.
I used to send my family links to watch an ambassador deliver the remarks that I wrote in the UN. And they'd be like, what are you talking about? That's some old guy. And I'm like, no, that's my work.
Yes, I wrote it. I did that. Yes, exactly.
I'm like tearing up as they say something that sounds just like bureaucratic, like robotic, whatever. We get really invested in what we're doing, right?
Yes, we do. We should.
And there are many hard-fought battles over a couple of words. So
absolutely.
Words matter.
Absolutely.
But now I really want to ask you a sort of tricky question, but I think you'll be up to the task. What do you think that the future of public service will look like in an ideal world? Because you've approached this work from so many different angles. And, you know, this is a period of a lot of change. And I think there's always opportunity in change. So I'm wondering, what do you think about the future?
Yeah, the future... it's going to be an uphill battle, truly.
Mm-hmm.
You know, rebuilding public service at the federal level is going to be a struggle when this administration changes over. Because for the longest time, really people thought that federal public service was the safest job path you could have. You know, you had the best benefits, you had the most protections, you had union protections. And now suddenly all of that has been shaken up and it's going to have a chilling effect, I think, of some people wanting to enter public service, but specifically federal public service.
Mm-hmm.
So I think really the future of public service needs to start with recruiting young, passionate people again. And that is also going to be a challenge when programs like PMF are now gone, which really brought in so much fresh talent out of school. You know, I was the first in my law school that I could find ever that entered the PMF program because public service just isn't a career path that some professions talk about. But there is just so much in public service that people don't think about. You know, the federal government, people know we hire attorneys and we hire public health people, but they don't understand the federal government also hires interior designers and engineers and librarians and administrative personnel. So it is so much more than just the people who have a master's of public policy or one of those degrees.
Right.
So we really need to make sure we're advertising to people what public service is and can be.
Because you're right. Like, you didn't know about PMF. I didn't know about PMF. I didn't know about many of the pathways that existed, and I was literally like trying to pursue a career in international affairs, but as the first in my family to go to college, like so much of it just felt like I was figuring it out on the fly. Yep. And so I do think we need to do a better job letting people know about these opportunities, but like, you know, even a couple of years ago, I would meet with interns and have conversations about how hard it is to get a foot in the door, even if with all the pathways that exist. And I think what people who do not have experience with applying for federal jobs need to understand is that like it is really hard on a good day. You have to be willing to go through a lengthy process with a lot of layers and a lot of barriers for many people. And then you also have to be willing to wait for a security clearance and have like the luxury of waiting or doing another job while you're applying and waiting. And there are so many obstacles. And this is a problem like for the diplomatic workforce.
Absolutely. And I think part of that goes to retention as well. You know,
Over
the past few years, I've seen a lot more effort put on recruitment and still not enough, but some effort being put on recruitment, but really almost no effort on retention. You know, the federal government or any employer puts a lot of time, money, and effort into recruiting you, training you, and all of that goes out the door when you go out the door. So it actually costs a lot more to recruit and train new people than it does to keep the people that they have now. So we need to continue to work on retention. And I think for me, anyway, the two biggest issues that I saw in the federal government were burnout issues and money issues.
Mm-hmm.
And money issues are something that's going to be hard to fix. You know, public service, you can make a decent salary. You know, I was pretty satisfied with my salary, but, you know, it's not the same as if I went into a private firm. with a law degree. So that's just, it is what it is. And I think that's important for people to understand. But really, burnout is a really difficult issue right now. We need to be making sure that our people are okay. And right now, they're not. Public servants are tired. They're working nonstop. They're the ones working through every emergency or crisis in the world. They're working while they're on vacations or while they're on sick leave. I mean, I have vivid memories of me checking my phone in some like island destinations on vacation, or when I'm sick on the couch with COVID, still checking my work email. Yeah. So we really need to be making sure that there are more programs aimed at burnout prevention and making sure there's actual feedback loops so that public servants can really actually share their honest thoughts and feedback about their jobs and their work-life balance. Because, you know, saying the word retention is not enough. It's important to hear people and really hear how they're doing and what their ideas are to make sure that they're okay.
Yeah, and this really all is so connected to the larger discussion about the future of work and how do we, like, as human beings, interact with our careers. And a lot of people in the last few years, certainly since COVID, have talked quite a bit about work-life balance. I think there was a period of time during the height of the pandemic where there was a lot of attention on, like, the employee experience and how people were doing mentally and emotionally because we were all not okay.
Yes.
But a lot of that has faded or, you know, well-intentioned programs have fizzled out and there's almost been kind of like a backlash. And I think that the only way to move forward is to continue to have a really thoughtful discussion around how we relate to our work. And that's one of the things that I hope that we do within this project, because especially for public servants, it's not just a job. You choose this work, you accept the challenges that you just outlined that come with the work because you feel really connected to the purpose and the mission. And so that means I think there's a higher potential for a really rewarding career and also higher risk for that burnout, for the potential to be off balance and to kind of like lose your way in service of the broader mission.
Yeah, you know, especially for those of us who are really feelers and emotional people, working on emotional issues every day is draining on your soul and your being. And of course, it's still what I want to do and it's still what I feel like I'm meant to do, but it's hard. You know, it's really, it was really hard every day hearing stories of survivors of horrible human rights abuses around the world and talking to people that are experiencing things that I could not even imagine that they're experiencing. And, you know, I'm a very empathetic person and I felt each and every story that I heard. And it's really difficult work and it's hard. And a lot of times we're not checking on our own people to make sure we're doing okay.
Yeah. Well, so what else do you want people to know about public servants, people who don't have experience serving and maybe who are hearing like a certain narrative about what public servants are doing or who public servants are? What do you want them to know?
Yeah, well, this is, I think, why I'm so glad that you have started this podcast, because I think for the longest time, public service was a career path that people really respected and valued. Mm-hmm. And over the last couple of years, it feels that the narrative has shifted to public servants being these lazy or radicalized or disobedient kind of people. And that's just not true. And these misconceptions are really so harmful. You know, public servants are some of the most hardworking people that I have ever known. And they're doing everything from making sure that your food is safe to eat, your passports are printed, your medicines are safe and effective, your planes stay in the sky, so much more. And, you know, there are some bad eggs in the public service world, as there are in any career field. And, you know, if there are public servants out there who are refusing to work or are insubordinate, then there should be consequences for those individuals.
Yeah,
I chose this career path because I wanted to make a difference. As I've told my story today, you know, I always wanted to make a difference and help people. I didn't do it because of the money or the prestige or because I really liked the hours that I would be working or that it was going to be easy work that I wouldn't have to really worry about or think about. I did it because I wanted to serve and I wanted to serve the American people and I wanted to do what I could as one person to make the lives of people better. And I've just always wanted to make a difference. And even if that difference is small, it's what I've wanted to do and what I will continue to do.
Yeah, a small good thing is still a good thing.
Absolutely.
And you have chosen to use your life and your energy to do something positive for the world. And I think we should mention, because we've been talking about this service experience in past tense, so like we should mention the fact that you were affected by the recent rifts at the State Department.
So yeah, it's been about a month now that I have been separated from the department. And so, you know, I'm reimagining what my public service life looks like now. But again, it's still focused on doing good. And so I'm looking at other jobs that, you know, number one on my list is, can I make a difference in this job? And so that's what I continue to do, even if I'm not a public servant in the federal level right now.
Yeah. Where are you looking? Like, what has drawn your attention?
Yeah, I've mostly been looking at NGOs and other nonprofits mm-hmm. that kind of get back to my roots of making a difference, specifically organizations that work on youth issues. And I know it's something you care about a lot as well. It's a passion of mine, and I've had so many incredible experiences in my social work program and my law program working for and with youth. So it's really something I'm trying to mm-hmm. find my next role getting back to doing. But yeah, I mean, I'm continuing to look at other career paths and state and local government as well. But you know, as I'm sure many listeners know, this is a really difficult time right now to be on the job market, because there are tens of thousands of federal employees that are looking for jobs, and we're all looking for the same kinds of jobs and similar career paths. So it's a really hard market right now, but
it is.
I'm not giving up, and I'm really focused on trying to do good in my next role.
Yeah. I think that's amazing, and I really look forward to seeing what that is for you. And I think there's probably some grief too, because being separated from what was like a wonderful way to practice your purpose is really sad and is really disappointing. But I also think it's causing a lot of people to get back to identifying what exactly it is that they care about, and recognizing that there are a lot of places to do that. When you've found a great place to do it, it's really hard to be like, wow, that place is not an option anymore. But as you're showing us and as you're saying, there are a lot of different ways to do the same kind of work, or even to learn how to do the work in a different way.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's something I've been really focused on in the last month, is kind of starting from scratch and re-examining what's important to me. You're right. It's very hard, especially those of us that worked at the State Department. There's not an easy correlation to another agency or another thing that does what State Department does. You know, there's not a local government that's asking for an international diplomat. That's just not something that they're really doing. But it's taken a lot of time for me to sit back and think, you know, what is important to me, and really finding nonprofits and local governments that are making such a difference in the lives of marginalized and vulnerable communities.
Yeah.
It's really inspiring me to think about what my next career path could be. And so I'm excited to see what comes next. I really am.
Yeah. And there are, I'm sure, things that you've learned from your experience at the State Department that you can certainly apply, recognizing certain facets of the marginalized community's experience that maybe other people in the organization aren't thinking about because they haven't looked at it from the angle that you have. And so I really look forward to seeing what you do, because I think it is going to be wonderful. And I hope that you find opportunities that match your level of passion and curiosity and your heart, because you have a really good one.
Thanks.
And we're so lucky to have had you working on behalf of the American people. And I just want to take a moment, Dylan, to thank you not only for coming on the show, but thank you for your service to our country.
Thank you. It really means a lot. And, you know, it was great working with you at State Department. It's great to reconnect with you here.
Yeah.
And I'm just so grateful to you for really building this platform to share my story and share the stories of everyone who has been on your podcast, to really show that, you know, there's no one face of public service. There's no one career path that has led people to where they are in the federal government. There are so many opportunities out there, and public service looks and feels so different to so many people. And you're really highlighting that. So I really appreciate what you're doing.
Well, thank you for saying that. And that is my goal. Like, our public servants are coming from everywhere across the country, and they're reflecting the full range of experience of what it means to be an American. And so I think who better to ask about where we've been and what we've learned, and also how we're going to apply that going forward. It's an ongoing project, but I'm really honored to have you joining me for it. And I just thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you. It's been an honor to be here.
It's my